This is the Specialty Coffee Podcast by Storyline Coffee Roasters. Today we have a very special guest on, Miguel Vicuña, and he has over 20 years experience in the coffee industry. He is a head judge for the World Barista Championships. He's a part of the Specialty Coffee Association. He's done the World Barista Guild and various competitions, so he has a wealth of knowledge as well as working for Sweet Bloom Coffee Roasters on their coffee importing side and purchasing as well. So, Miguel, thank you so much for coming on, man. I'm excited to have you.
Yeah, no, it's a pleasure to be here. Really excited for this.
That's awesome. So let's kind of dive into the competition side of things. What is it like being a judge for the World Barista Championship?
It is a crazy thrill. Every time I go on stage, I'm like constantly nervous because, you know, you're getting served amazing coffee by some of the best baristas around the world. And you're just trying to be there and capture all the information they're giving you and then taste their tasty beverages and then assess it. So it's just like there's so much going on. But yeah, it's always like a really awesome thrill to just kind of see what baristas are bringing to the table and anything that's like kind of innovative or just really wild or and then just the, like the really awesome beverages that come out. Yeah, it's kind of nerve wracking, but in an exhilarating way. I never want to miss anything. So I'm trying to be their best customer and just like absorb everything. And I wish I could ask questions during it, but yeah. Yeah, you're just trying to absorb and just like be the best customer as possible.
Totally. Yeah. What's a question that's it's fascinating that you are nervous, because I can only imagine on their side of things, they've got to be incredibly nervous. They've put so much time and effort into these competitions. But what's one of the like questions or things that you wish you could ask them as they were presenting?
I think it's just like maybe more clarification on what they're trying to explain. Some of them go into so much science, and you're like, oh, wait. So, and if you kind of know anything about it, then you're like, oh, does it mean that it breaks down into this component or what did you actually mean by, I don't know. There's like a lot of just like little small questions that could potentially get clarified. And then it's really funny when I watch these performances like online again, the MC will ask those questions and then they'll answer it. And I'm like, oh, okay. I mean, this is like, you know, months down the road. It's like,
right.
I'm like watching these like later on, but yeah, I'm like, oh, okay, cool. That's like, that's really interesting. Cause it's like so fast paced. 15 minutes is like nothing, but also like an eternity at sometimes.
I'm sure. Well, especially for them, I can.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah, they're trying to pack so much into such a short time because they're not only explaining things as they're brewing, but they're also brewing and wanting to be engaging and, you know, properly communicate the beverage and what they've all put into it and everything like that. I can only imagine as they're going into the science of it, you've got to be trying to digest that as well as then they're moving on to already the next thing as you're digesting. So,
yeah. Yeah, and that's just like kind of the fast paced like realm of judging. You're like, whoa, wait, is that kind of like translating to the cup or isn't it? Or yeah, it's pretty fast.
Yeah, and then you've got to try to remember it all because you're not tasting it as they're presenting. You're tasting it after the fact. So then you've got to try to remember what did they convey, what information, what science, what processing methods, or whatever it may be in their beverage, what ingredients have they used, and then how is that actually translating to what I'm tasting?
Yeah, exactly. And that's just like, it's something, and timing goes into it quite a bit. You know, some competitors will kind of name off all their, and then they're also describing the beverage. So you're like trying to put together all the information there. They describe their beverage and then you're tasting it. And if they're already moving on to the next thing, you're like, oh, whoa, like, all right, we're there. Like I got this beverage. Like let's roll.
Yeah, that's
so
crazy.
Yeah, note taking, I think, is probably the number one thing that I'd really try to focus on as a judge is, taking the best notes I can, not writing what they say, but why they said or how the connection is, and then writing down my experience. Like, that's probably the number one thing for me is really concisely writing down the experience that I had with the beverage and their explanation towards the beverages in such a way where if they got my score sheet, they knew what happened. Like there's no kind of like guessing, I guess, behind it. And I always try to give that to them because sometimes like you will never get to talk to that competitor. And the only thing they have to kind of improve from is your score sheet.
Fascinating.
So if those are like really bare, I feel like I'm doing a disservice to them. So I'm constantly like writing like a novel of like my experience and how it connected or where it didn't, or, you know, those kind of things.
Yeah, absolutely. Is there space after the competition is going for you to be able to connect with the competitors? And is that something that happens or is it discouraged? Like kind of what's that space like behind the scenes or after the fact?
Yeah, no, there's definitely time and space for competitors to talk with judges. It's we call it debriefing, where, you know, competitors can talk to their judges and be like, hey, you wrote this down. Like, what did you mean by that? You know, just give me a sense of like where this connected or where it didn't. And yeah, so you do have some time. And then, you know, potentially, you know, everyone's always kind of exchanging emails. So if there are any follow-up questions or anything like that, there's always time to kind of like hone in on that. But once the competition's over and that debrief is like super crucial because it's like, it's all fresh. Like ask me, you know, 3 months after a competition, I'll be like, wait, what did I write down? And that's where like notes are like super important. Cause like it can maybe jar my like memory and like, oh yeah, no, I think it was mainly this, or, you know, cause as a judge, you might be seeing 6 to 10 competitors in a day. And, you know, it's really hard to kind of keep track. It's like, oh wait, who was that? What was that? And if you don't have really good notes, it's like really tough to just kind of move forward.
Yeah. How many competitors are there at the start of the competition? And then how does it work its way to where you have then a finalist?
Within the world level, I think for barista, we've had, 36
in
the first round. And then 36 whittles down to 12, and then 12 to the final six. So, yeah.
Dang.
Yeah, you have to,
that's crazy.
Yeah, the semifinals is 12 competitors, and then the finals is 6. So,
have you seen a lot of repeat competitors make it to the semifinals and finals year after year? And do you feel that that's something that they've just been able to hone in as a skill? Or do you see new and up and coming people entering the world barista level? Or is it such a high level of competition that is just so hard to obtain?
I think it really comes down to the size of the country and the pool. The U.S. is so big, and usually any of the top six in the U.S. will, you know, potentially go into the semifinals of the world. So I think it's more based on country a lot of the times.
Makes sense.
So yeah. So I mean, trying to think of multiple. Yeah, I think it really kind of just comes down to the size of the pool of the country and then how far they like kind of make it normally throughout the world. It's more based on country. So like Australia is always really strong. Really interesting coffee culture down there. New Zealand was pretty predominant for a little while. The UK, US, Japan, Taiwan. So yeah, it's like it's kind of...
Yeah.
Always up or down. I'm still waiting for an African country to kind of like make it to the semis and make it into the finals with like, with like really awesome vigor. Because that'll be amazing.
Yeah, I feel like with so much coffee that comes out of Africa, and it would just be so cool to see them represented on that stage, you know, because it's not typically what you think of when you think of that country. You know, you think of coffees, you think of Ethiopias and Kenyas and everything else, but you don't really think of like incredible, you know, world barista champions coming out of there. So it'd be awesome to see that.
Yeah. And like, I think, two of my favorite competitors to watch and just watch their performances, live and online have been, Martin from Kenya. His performance went to the semifinals, I think, in 2027 or no, 2017. Gosh.
Yeah. I was like, whoa.
Yeah. 2017. And then Wilson from South Africa last year, like his performance was like stellar, and he missed semis by like, you know, just a little bit. And I was really, really stoked to kind of see maybe both of them kind of move forward, in those prospective years. Cause like, they're just really awesome performance and really fantastic baristas, and they're doing a lot of stuff with coffee. And maybe not having as much support as like other countries, but it's a wild game for sure.
Yeah, no kidding. What does it take to be able to get to be one of those top 36? Like, how do you, I guess, qualify for the World Barista Championship?
Yeah, so it depends on the country. Like within the U.S., we are so big that we have prelims or preliminary rounds, where those are pretty kind of like lo-fi, straight down and dirty. Like for barista, it's serving two espressos and two milk beverages with compulsory coffee. So it's kind of like really wild.
Yeah, no kidding.
Yeah, and then we have the qualifiers, which are coming up in Baltimore and here in Denver in February and March. Then it kind of expands out, four judges, four espressos, four signature beverages. So it's kind of building on top of each other. And then the top six of those go to the U.S. championship, where there's still like, I think, an open service or open registration. But that's like in the U.S. So it's like three rounds of competing.
Wow.
In other countries, potentially they might have regionals. Colombia does a really great job. I think they have like four regionals within their country, and then they all feed into the national championships. Some other countries might just have a championship because, they might get 12 competitors and, roll through. And that's just kind of based on, size and community. So, but yeah, I think the U.S.
That makes sense.
The longest road to get to the world level. And it is pretty steep when you get to the U.S. Yeah.
Totally. I can only imagine then, these competitors have put so much time and effort to even just get there. And then by the time they're there, there's so much pressure. It's such a big stage. There's so much notoriety that comes from even just making it to the semifinals or, being in the top six. And so it is fascinating just to imagine the pressure and everything. And I'm sure they feel it. And it's cool just to see how polished their, performances are.
Yeah, I feel like when I first started with Jumaan, this was in 2009. I started off as a technical judge, and just kind of watching different baristas kind of do their thing really helped me hone in my barista skills. But yeah, watching the finalists, you're just like, oh, whoa, there's no wasted movement. Everything flows into the next course. No ways, like it can be done. You just have to like really hone in that skill, and that's like it's really amazing to kind of watch bar flow happen on that stage for sure.
Yeah, you see efficiency at its finest, and it's amazing because like I can't multitask to save my life, and so seeing like how well they're able to, they're so precise, they're so exact. Every, there's like you said, there's no waste of movement. And they're also communicating in such an in-depth and beautiful way to convey what they're trying to get across that like it's fascinating to watch. I mean, I would love just to see them, in their element and see, because I'm sure that translates back into, their home shops and wherever they're working on a regular basis, just to, they probably can carry on a full-blown conversation and talk about varietals and processing methods and why they selected this coffee for this beverage and everything just like on a regular basis.
Yeah. We would hope so, right? Yeah, I think.
Right, yeah, totally.
I think this is the funny thing. It's like I would love to just go into someone's shop and see what happens. It's like the stage is the stage. Like they've rehearsed that so many times. But yeah, no, I'm sure that whatever service that comes out of their bars is just like kind of just fun and connected.
Totally. So you've been a judge for what, almost 14 years now?
Yeah.
No, it's amazing. How have you seen the competition progress through those years, and what do you feel like the future for the World Barista Championship has in store? I know there's some changes that just came in this year, but kind of take us through that history and what you've seen and how it's progressed.
Yeah, I think when it first started, or at least when I started, it was really very much focused on educating not just like the audience or consumers, but also like baristas. Like a lot of it was based in fundamentals. So the technical score sheet back then looks way different than it does now. The format's still fairly the same, But yeah, it kind of was more based on solidifying foundational skills as a barista. So just making coffee and talking about it.
Yeah.
And then within the last 14 years, really watching baristas like really shine and push the boundaries of like what service is, or even within the rules, like kind of pushing the boundaries on how far something can go, has been really awesome to see. And yeah, with some of the cool rule changes that we have now for just barista, at least at this moment, is like, you know, adding alternative milks to the milk beverage. Or even just like when we, or when the competitions change to not just a cappuccino, but you can showcase this milk beverage in any size. I think we're always constantly like, we start with a foundation and then it's evolved to showcase more flair and ingenuity and creativity from the barista that kind of moving forward, which has been really awesome. Yeah. Like even the stage layout. Oh man, I was talking to someone about this as when I started, baristas had to actually set the table.
Oh wow.
Yeah, in their performance. Like they didn't, you know, the stage wasn't set. It was like they brought out their cart, put, you know, like
that's right.
If they, they did like white tablecloth, like they put the white tablecloth and then set all the saucers, and yeah, there's like this setting of the table moment, which was really fun. And also back then, I think MCs were allowed to ask them questions during their performance, which was wild to think about now.
Yeah, because you could get thrown a curveball in the middle of it.
Oh, yeah.
You know, like as a competitor, like you've got, not only you're preparing all this, but also you've got like a guy who may ask you a question randomly.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm like, oh, I was like, that would actually be kind of fun to bring back.
Yeah, totally.
Or maybe in maybe a different competition. I think the barista's kind of gone to the point of, you know, the performance is like so big. And it's such a huge stage. It's a big platform to get your message across. But maybe, I don't know, like maybe Coffee and Good Spirits might be a really awesome place because it's supposed to be fun.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, when you go to a cocktail bar, you can ask your bartender a bunch of questions and, you know, they'll kind of engage with you. I think that's probably where I hope some of those competitions go, is like more engagement from like potentially the judges or maybe the MC or something like that.
Yeah, because I think it ultimately you're wanting to, you know, and you even mentioned this with the notes that you give of like your connection to it and if they conveyed their points correctly, but there's a certain level of like of intimacy that's brought when you're able to actually engage. And even if it's just from the MC, I think inadvertently you get that as a viewer of just like, oh yeah, like that's a great question. And you know, you see how intimately they know every aspect of their beverage and of the espresso and everything that goes into it, the milk they chose, and you know, this coming year of maybe why they chose an alternative milk and how that changes things and the chemistry of that milk. And you know, there's a lot that can be gleaned from that kind of dialogue back and forth, which would be fascinating to see. And I think, you know, like the Coffee and Good Spirits, I think would be a cool platform because like you said, a bar just has that atmosphere already built into it, you know, so. But so what, I know that there's alternative milks. What other changes have been brought into the stage coming in this year?
Yeah, so alternative milks is probably the biggest one. Another one is, I think, size of cup for espresso isn't a thing anymore. Like, you can kind of serve it as you want to express it. But a lot of the scoring kind of elements have changed quite a bit, especially when it comes to flavor descriptors or sensory descriptors within the espresso milk beverage and signature beverage. We typically score on a 0 to 6 scale. But for those, it's going to be a 1 through 3 scale. And it's kind of to help the judges kind of just hone in on what that is. But then also not nitpick. I think sometimes like, you know, a competitor will say something really awesome and interesting. You know, they'll say it's, oh, this is going to be like, strawberry parfait, and you get strawberry, or as a judge you get strawberry, you get yogurt, but it might not be parfait, you know, or
You're missing that granola or that richness or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Or I always think it's like Snickers bars. Like someone will say a Snickers bar. It's like chocolate, peanut butter, caramel, and nougat. And, you know, I don't know. Sometimes it gets to the point where it was like, well, I kind of get all those, but it didn't taste like a Snickers bar. And so I think we're missing the point of like people describing things and then getting super nitpicky about it. And it's also really tough. If it's generally there, I think that's awesome. If it's so not there, then it's pretty straightforward. Like there's no need to nitpick.
Right.
70% dark chocolate versus.
Yeah. Right. Totally. Or because then, you know, you're splitting hairs at that point. And the reality is you're, you know, I think the competitor has only so much control over their beverage, you know, and I think it's fascinating too, because palates are so subjective, right? Like you could taste I really get this rich, chocolatey, creamy mouthfeel. And I'm like, yeah, I get chocolate, but it's more a bittering chocolate, you know, and that just could be a different thing in palate. And, you know, that, and so it also kind of plays into I can only imagine how difficult it must be as a judge, which goes back to your experience of you have to really be able to hone in your own tasting palate and how to identify different flavor notes and mouthfeels and everything that goes into that.
Yeah. And then when there's flavor descriptors being called out from areas of the world that you don't have access to those fruits. Mm. You're just what?
Totally.
What does that taste like? What is that? On some of the, you know, anytime I go into Latin America for competitions, you know, one, it's in Spanish, and then two, totally different fruit profiles than the States. I'm constantly asking, what does that taste like? And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. That's actually really similar. I've never tasted it. And then the cool thing is you get to go out to the market and then try and find those fruits.
Yeah, totally.
So it's like super fun to judge just to go out and find those things. And I'm always what is that? What is that? It's dragon fruit. Someone described that. And I was like, okay, cool. So I went out and I tried to find dragon fruit. And dragon fruit here is way different when you have it than in Vietnam or something. So.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah. And just the freshness of it, and you're getting it in the environment and the culture, which is also a cool aspect of it, is you know, being a judge, you get to travel to all these different cultures and areas. And I'm sure those different cultures have a lot of influence on the competitors and, you know, what they're bringing to the table. And to get that cultural aspect of it's got to be just cool to see on a world stage, as opposed to you know, a lot of people in America won't be able to travel to all these different areas and experience not only the culture, but also the coffee of that area. So, no, that's fascinating. So what advice would you give someone who maybe, you know, is doing latte art throwdowns or different things? What would you recommend, or what advice would you give to someone who maybe wants to take it to that next level or is competing really well, but just is intimidated by that stage or by competitions and getting in front of people? What advice would you give to someone who's kind of in that stage?
I would say try to treat every customer interaction as if it is kind of that stage. If you're serving a coffee that you're really excited about, talk to customers about it. And if you have a bar service that kind of helps facilitate that a little bit. I think that's kind of number one. Cause that's what baristas hopefully you're doing day to day. You know, the latte art stuff is super awesome. That's kind of just so hyper-focused and the pour, you got to look up and connect with the customer. So I think if you're really looking at it, try to, incorporate some sort of semblance of, connecting a customer to the coffee that you're serving, or even just the beverage, you know, if it's your, espresso, your house espresso, and you're serving it with an alternative milk, give it a go and try and explain what the difference is between that alternative milk and whole milk or whole cow milk or, you know, something like that. I think there's always little aspects. People are always oh, I don't have enough time to practice. I'm like, you can practice every day.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah, or, you know, it's like develop, you know, signature beverage programs for your cafes. Like, those are always really great. And if you're supporting the coffee that you're serving, I think that kind of really translates to the barista competitions. Or even it's like pour overs, you know, describing how you're doing your pour over and why you're doing it and those kind of things. You can do that with customers. And if you do that with a customer, you can totally do that on a stage.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, the nerves get pretty high, but if right. you just treat the judges like a competitor, the judges like a customer, like, I think that's where
you've done it thousands of times prior.
Totally.
Yeah, absolutely. No, that's great advice. And I think, you know, it's cool to see in the specialty coffee industry, you know, like seasonal beverages and specialty beverages that are just coming out. I think, you know, years prior, it was like there was one on the menu, you know, and that would rotate every so often. But now I think it's becoming more of, which I think is just diversifying the industry. You're able to allow someone to, who has intimate knowledge of the coffee that they're serving, then be able to also connect and pair certain elements into that that are going to accentuate the coffee. So, you know, if you have a really like juicy coffee, you can add in different fruits or different, you know, milks to balance that out. And that's going to accentuate it. You know, I always love like deconstructed lattes because like, here's the espresso, here's the milk, and here's it all together. Like, it drastically changes it. And I think it's cool to then, you know, incorporate like, hey, this is why this alternative milk is going to change the taste and the texture of it. And, you know, all those different components of it. So.
Yeah. And I think it's really awesome to kind of showcase them. Like, I think, yeah, definitely explaining it to customers is like the next step. I think that will help elevate service above and beyond. Cause I think that's like kind of like what I get at like at cocktail bars. I'll be like, oh, we're like, tell me about this cocktail. And most of the time it's just like, they just tell me the ingredients and that's it. And I'm like, oh, okay, cool. Like, you know, like what was the thought process behind it? And some bartenders are like really fantastic and they'll take you through the whole thing. It's like, oh, this is like a riff off this classic, but I like this flavor profile or, you know, those kind of things. I think baristas can definitely do that with those signature beverages, kind of moving forward. So not just just serving signature beverage, but like really engaging, with the customer about that signature beverage is like something that I hope kind of translates out. I think it can, I think it does.
No, I think it's always, I feel like coffee, you know, in the wine industry, the cocktail industry, I feel like there's so much connections. And I think coffee industry always pulls from those other industries with, you know, different processing methods, like your carbonics and different things like that and macerations and, you know, even on the processing sides of coffee, but also, you know, on the signature beverage of, you know, I think good bars that you go to will have that experience of like, this is why I'm doing what I'm doing. And this barrel aging is going to affect it like this. And to counteract that, we've added some, you know, orange bitters and, you know, the rim will give you that pop of citrus, but then balance it, you know, like all of those different things would then incorporate to a good customer experience. And I think that's what separates specialty coffee from, you know, your Starbucks where you're just selecting a menu and you're in and out.
Yeah.
You know, it's that deeper level of an understanding. And I think that's what fascinates so many people that they quickly slip down the rabbit hole of what is specialty coffee.
Yeah,
that's fascinating. So you're a Q grader. How did you get to that point? And like, for a lot of people, I think in the industry or consumers, I think us kind of behind the scenes have a good understanding of what a Q grader does. But I think for the consumer, that's something that is sometimes kept behind the scenes. So can you explain what it is to be a Q grader and how you got there?
Yeah. So being a Q grader means that I can score and evaluate green coffee on a 0 to 100 scale. So I can grade and identify defects within the green, roast defects, potentially if that's kind of happening, and assess its quality within the cupping platform. And yeah, so that's kind of like what being a Q grader is being able to harness like this international language of identifying quality and, you know, tracking quality versus defects and things like that within green coffee. I got there just based on volunteering quite a lot for the Specialty Coffee Association, and kind of like really, really kind of just honing in on cupping. And I was like, oh, well, you know, what kind of things could be in a Q grader bring forward? And on the green side for me, like that's kind of like my passion now is kind of like connecting with more on the producing side and then talking with, you know, producers and, you know, kind of having more of a common language to kind of draw from in the sense of, you know, quality and not growing practices or processing practices. Because like the CQI is really pushing forward on the processing classes, which I'm hoping to take sometime in the near future. But yeah, but as a Q grader, you're kind of there as like, you know, qualitative assessments. And for me, assessing coffees on a qualitative level, I guess, has always been there for, you know, almost close to 14 years with barista competitions. Yeah. And yeah, I think just kind of connecting more towards origin was why I really went for the Q grader thing. A lot of people say it's like a sommelier-esque of coffee, and I'm always kind of like, that's a sure. For having not to have to really, really explain it. Because, like, I don't know, it's like, it's just different. Coffee is like so wild, so many facets that can change the cup that, I mean, a true sommelier of coffee would, I don't know. I don't even know if that would even exist, but like you just know so much more about everything and anything, and it's so big, and it's always like a constantly moving target. I think with wine, you know, 20 years ago someone bottled that wine, and you can kind of like track back like the quality of that wine back then, but with coffee it's so seasonal and so many variables on just the finished product that it's like pretty hard to say you're like super sommelier of coffee.
Yeah, totally. What is it like getting that qualification? Like what's the testing like? What do you have to do like with defects and things like that?
Yeah. So that's like a full week of, it's a full week and there's classes or, you know, courses that you take, and then tests, like nonstop sensory tests. You know, there's it's a lot of cupping. So there's different tables. You know, there's washed Africans, washed Latin Americans, Indonesians, or Southeast Asia, and then processing. So there's you know, table of naturals, and you have to kind of score and assess them to the certified Q grader instructor. So you have to be like calibrated with them. And be able to like write notes that make sense. And, so yeah, the cupping side is like pretty intense. And then there's like the sensory, exercises as well. Like, I think they do, sweet, sour, and salt. And you have to identify like different levels of intensity of those three components, aligned. And then they mix and match those components. And then you have to like identify the intensity and what's inside that mixture. So it could be like, you know, level one intensity to three intensity, three being the most. you know, this cup has level two sweetness, level one salt, and level one acid.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was like a really fun test. Also very nerve wracking because you're like, oh, is there salt? No, because it's sweet. But sometimes when you add salt to something, it makes it sweet. And you just like
right, like the salted caramel deal.
Yeah, exactly. You're just like, oh man. But it's super fun, I think. And then there's like olfactory, you know, Le Nez de Café sensory aromatic tests where you have to smell certain aromas and identify what that aroma is.
Wow.
And then roast defects, like what's baked, what's, you know, over roasted, what's under roasted. And then with the green side, like, yeah, identifying green defects according to SEA is kind of standard on green defects. So, you know, what's a primary, what's a secondary. And then they give you kits that that you have to kind of green grade. And if you hit it, like, you kind of pass that test. But if you're, like, calling, you know, certain defects that aren't found within that kit, like, then you fail.
Wow.
Yeah, so it's a full week of kind of courses and then also exams on the sensory level. And it's like, yeah, full days of lots of coffee, lots of weird solutions.
Yeah.
But it's, like, super fun. And, you know, it's like not everyone passes it the first time. I didn't. I failed the naturals table. I'm a little harsh on naturals.
Yeah.
And I'm also, like, really, really hypersensitive to, like, kind of ferment. And so it's kind of like, I was, like, cupping. I was like, oh, man, I think this one has, like, I think it has it. I called in. It's not technically there, but everyone else is like, yeah, I kind of caught something off that cup, too. I'm like, oh, man, okay, well.
Yeah, I'm not the only one, at least.
Yeah, exactly. But I was like, I'm going for it. I think I know it's there.
Right. Yeah. And you've got to, at a certain point, trust your gut, trust your palate. Yeah. And also under, you know, like you said, like you're, you know, sensitive to certain compounds or certain tasting notes, and you've got to be able to understand that this is my palate and try to overcome that, you know, in the cup. And I think that's, you know, not easy to do because on one hand, you've got to trust what you're tasting. On the other hand, you've got to understand your palate and, you know, how you tend to kind of err on one side or the other.
Yeah, exactly. And I think Naturals Premier is like one of those, like, I really just have to hone in on, is this me being biased or am I getting this, like, moving forward? Or is it not as intense as I think it is? Yeah, it's super fun.
Yeah.
Yeah.
How do you, when you're cupping, how do you kind of walk through that process of, like, what is the first thing that you taste for? And then how do you then move to the next? And how do you kind of progress through as you cup different coffees?
Oh, that's a good question. I think for me, it's like really identifying the major flavors that are there as much as possible and really starting off maybe more on the positive side. And then if like kind of those negative aspects, like, I don't know, like age or, you know, ferment start popping up, really hone in on, like, is it qualitative? Like, is this ferment or is this, like, and then look at intensity. I think that's kind of how I approach a lot of tasting is intensity, then goes into complexity, quality, clarity. So how identifiable are those flavors, and then the longevity of it. So my brain just moves through those five things.
Yeah.
And if they're all positive, then that's a stellar coffee.
Yeah. No kidding.
But then I kind of look at based on that. So kind of going through those five things, like that's kind of how I taste one coffee and then go to the next one. And, you know, different coffees are going to have different combinations of those. But yeah, I think that's probably like my primary focus is like those five things in kind of that order. Like,
yeah.
Yeah.
No, it's fascinating. I think for people that are cupping, it can be such an overwhelming, you know, you're so often we taste something and we know what it should taste like, right? And so, you know, you have a bite of lasagna, you know that it's going to be cheesy and have red sauce and have pasta and what that's going to taste. And then but if you were to say to someone like, hey, what are the, you know, seasonings used in that lasagna? They'd be like, what? You know, so I think there's a lot of that with when a coffee, like, you know, you get certain notes that pop out at you, but then it's like, okay, now let's dissect that. Like, what is that that you're tasting? You know, what is the sweetness? What is the, like, savory? You know, how long is it lingering on your palate? Is it, you know, a clean finish? Is it lingering? You know, all those different things. And having to identify that can be overwhelming to a lot of people, especially when you're sitting at a table with, I remember the first cupping I ever did. I think there was like 40 coffees on the table, and it was at Corvus, and there was like farmers that were there that brought their coffees. And so I was super intimidated. And I was like, wait, and you know, like you're like super jittery by the end of it because like each little sip, and it probably nerves, right? Because I was like, I think Phil was in front of me and then Danielle was behind me, and I was like, oh man, like don't screw this up, Tyler. You know, like, and again, there's no pressure, right? But yeah, you feel that inadvertently. And but yeah, it's a fun experiment and it's a fun process to do. And I just think that there's so much that you can glean from that, that then helps you when you get a cup at a shop to be able to, you know, like, oh, I actually am tasting that. This isn't just a marketing thing of like, you know, stone fruit or, you know, a strawberry parfait, right, but it's actually like, oh, I actually get that creamy mouthfeel and that sweetness to it. Yeah. And be able to identify that.
Yeah, totally. And I think that's like the other side. Like sometimes flavors do kind of interact with a textural component that I think kind of gets missed sometimes. Like, oh yeah, this is kind of yogurty. And like really you get like, you know, sour, condensed, like,
yeah.
No, it's more like in the texture. I'm like, oh, I totally get you now.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's just like, yeah, the more you talk, I think that's like the number one thing I love about cupping or just tasting coffees with other people is just asking more questions. Like, what do you mean by that? Or is it textural or is it sense? Is it aroma? Or is it this? And you can kind of like, yeah, like you said, just glean a lot off of experienced cuppers. And also, you know, I get a lot from people who've never really cupped before, or you get their perceptions on what coffee could be. I know I do some public cuppings with people, and we have a Peru on that are like, oh, this has to be from Africa. I'm like, actually, this is from Peru. So it's kind of like fun breaking people's like minds about that, but also kind of seeing what context customers have about certain regions, which is kind of fun.
Yeah, totally. Because, you know, there's certain conceptions of like, this coffee should taste this way. And especially now with the coffee industry progressing so much and processing methods and varietals and everything, that like you really can't have a Mexico that tastes like an Ethiopia, you know? And it's just like, whoa, like this is not something that you tend to ever see from a Mexican coffee. And, you know, I love roasting coffees like that just because it is so unique and it pushes people's boundaries to understand like, yeah, like coffee can taste, you know, there's so much that goes into it, whether the soil elevation, you know, what, you know, was it in shade? Was it in sun primarily? Like all those things have large impacts on taste, and to be able to bring that to someone and then educate them, I think is what I love about specialty coffee so much, is because it just gives you that opportunity to kind of open people's eyes to, there's this whole world behind this, you know, caffeinated beverage that you drink every morning. But what would you say? So there was a sensory lexicon. I think it was brought out in like 2015, 16 timeframe ish. Do you feel like that helped solidify language for the coffee industry? And do you feel like, I love that lexicon just in the sense of it provides language and kind of universal language. So what are your thoughts on the sensory lexicon and language behind explaining things?
I think it's awesome. And if you get to read the lexicon or like how they incorporated, like, I think they explain like that blueberry is actually Kroger's blueberry something. So you can actually go out and taste that, and buy it. I think that was really awesome that they kind of explained what their basis for those flavors were. And I just love using the wheel because, it's a really great tool just to kind of start general and then work your way out to specific, which is, I think, the number one thing for new people coming into coffee, new baristas or new cuppers, roasters, whatever. It's just like a really good tool to kind of like essentially start your process of thinking or evaluating a little bit more, where you start general and then work your way out to something that is more specific. And then reading through the lexicon and actually doing some of the exercises in there, I think helps like push people to just really understand what they're tasting, which is awesome.
Yeah, no, that's awesome. What are some of those? I've read through the lexicon. I haven't done any of the like experiments or, you know, things that they have you do. What are some of those that they kind of, you know, what does that get you to?
I haven't done them either. Like, I've kind of read through some of them, and I'm like, they're like super interesting. But I think they also go through like sweet intensities. I think I've done that in a Q Reser, where you taste shredded wheat versus like a frosted flake. So that's cereal, but one's like intensity of sweetness is zero, and one that's intensity based on, you know, a hedonistic scale that is like five. So it's like, yeah, so there's a lot of cool things that you can kind of do. for me, it's a lot of breaking down varieties. So like apples, I think, are always a great place to start with, you know, Granny Smith, tasting that next to a Red Delicious, like you're going to understand acidity.
Totally. Yeah. Quickly.
Yeah. And then, you know, I always tell people, it's like, well, try an unripe and an ripe and an overripe strawberry, and then you will see what sweetness and balance looks like when it's ripe. I think ripe strawberries are like my quintessential fruits for identifying balance. It's like fruity, slightly tart, sweet. But when you go into an overripe strawberry, it's just like funky. And then unripe is just like tart and kind of vegetal.
Yep.
So that, for me, that's like always like a good explanation. Like, oh yeah, no, this is like balance in a coffee. Like, if you can make a coffee taste like a strawberry, a ripe strawberry, then that's awesome.
Totally. And I think what I always encourage people when they're like, how do I develop my palate? I'm like, man, taste foods. And like, you know, a lot of people don't like whip out a journal and start like writing stuff down while they're eating, but like take mental notes of like, okay, this is what I'm eating. Cause we in our mind have an idea of like what a strawberry tastes like. Like you just said, a ripe strawberry versus an unripe strawberry tastes really differently. And there's acidity in a strawberry that we don't typically, when we think of a strawberry, you know, identify, but that is there and that's a component. And so being able to actually like, okay, this is the mouthfeel. This is, you know, the sweetness, this is the acidity. And like, breaking those things down as you progress through food then helps you identify when you're tasting coffee. And I think it helps, you know, and that's what I love about the lexicon is that there's a universal language to it, because there's, you know, like a Hershey's chocolate is universally available across the world. And so you could go to Asia or Europe, you know, or Africa and say like, oh, that's Hershey's chocolate. And they'll go, oh yeah, that is. Whereas like stone fruit for us is like, well, I mean, I've heard of it. I've seen pictures of it online. I think it's pink, but like outside of that, I don't know, you know.
Or even like getting Palisade peaches versus peaches from somewhere else.
Totally. And that's what I love about the culture too. Like I had a friend bring me chocolate from New Zealand and I was like, whoa, like this is like, it was rich and like sweet and like, you know, they was talking about like the, it's because of the like cows and the milk that comes from New Zealand. And like, that's so different than what you're going to get in America for chocolate. And so if you were to say chocolate to someone in New Zealand, they'd be like, they would have an idea of what it is. And I would have an idea like, oh yeah, I mean, it's good, but they're like, oh no, it's rich and creamy and sweet and all those things. So
yeah, chocolate's kind of like one of those like fun industries that I'm really excited to see kind of advance forward, because it is like on the same level as specialty. Like 20 years ago, I'd maybe say, or maybe even closer than that. Varieties of cacao, processing of cacao, tempering, all those stuff. Like for the longest time, that was like all done in big factories, and I think in Europe. but now, you know, it's like varieties, location, terroir, all that stuff's like coming into play, and it's like making a huge difference in the flavor, which is like pretty awesome. So it's like, yeah, I don't know. It's like so fun to just taste things. And I think that's like the number one thing I tell people is like, oh, if you want to get better at tasting coffee, get better at tasting everything else.
Yeah,
you can taste coffee all day, every day, but building your library of or I used to say Rolodex, but I don't think a lot of people know what a Rolodex is anymore.
Hey man, I still do, so I'm with you.
Yeah, so it's like, yeah, just building that library or that dictionary of flavors in your mind, and that only happens by just experience food.
Yeah, absolutely. Where do you feel like the specialty coffee industry is headed in the next, you know, 5-10 years? What do you think are some like emerging trends that you think will take off? What do you think may fizzle or fade? What are your kind of thoughts from someone who's seen the industry for so long and is also involved in a lot of different sectors of it?
I think, climate change and dealing with that, I hope, always stays in the forefront. And we do a lot more research on how to like evolve with it, which I do think that is happening. I think one thing, you know, 20 years ago, there wasn't that much research or science behind a lot of things that we did. It was like a lot of pseudoscience.
I think
like, you know, dark roast coffee has less caffeine than light roast coffee. Mm-hmm. You know, it's burned. Like caffeine's a pretty stable agent and it doesn't burn off. There's other things that are causing some different things. But I think like research on varieties, and then, yeah, just processing kind of going the way it is, I think we'll maybe hopefully find a good balance of like sustainable processing moving forward rather than, I think there's so much cool experimentation happening, but like, what does that mean on a bigger scale?
Right.
And I think specialty, the percentage of specialty coffee is growing, which is awesome. I'm hoping it like keeps growing and growing because, I think that's probably going to be the number one place where hopefully, if specialty kind of grows and producers are being compensated for their efforts into producing coffee, regardless of quality, you know, it's like if even we can just figure out how to make or create a structure where producers are price makers rather than price takers, then I think sustainability could definitely, hopefully, potentially grow further rather than vice versa, where, you know, farms are getting left because, like, no one's there to manage them, or it's not lucrative anymore. There's so much, I think, that can happen, and I think we're having a lot of great conversations about that. So hopefully, like, the cool thing is like, oh, wow, it's not cool. Change doesn't happen overnight. And I think the conversations that we have right now are going to make coffee that much better. Because even I think a lot of the conversation now, even just on the barista side, is like sustainable wages.
Right.
That's a huge thing, right? Just on the service side and the producer side. And like those are conversations are kind of coming forward. And there's a lot of things kind of happening from that. So it's pretty cool.
Yeah. And I think too, just the understanding that like, I think educating as more and more customers come into the market and understand specialty coffee, educating them as to like why your bag of coffee costs $16, $20 as opposed to $10 and why that matters and what that means for sustainability and what that, like how many hands touch this coffee before it's in your hand and giving the consumer who may be new to specialty coffee and first comes in and like looks at the menu and looks at, you know, the price of coffee and is like, what is all this? But actually getting, which I think goes back to the baristas of educating consumers and having a welcoming environment to like, hey, you know nothing. Like, that's amazing you're here. Like, let me dumb my crazy knowledge down to you and explain why I'm passionate about it and be okay with the fact that you know nothing, right? And I think that there's such a opportunity for, and I think the coffee industry is doing a better and better job of this. And so I think that the more that happens, the more that sustainable practices can be implemented and that those prices can be better distributed to all levels, whether it be the barista and the importers and, you know, the producers. And, you know, I think that the more that we focus now, like you just said, I think that that'll have a lasting impact moving forward. So yeah, it's fascinating. So to kind of wrap up, what's something, I always love asking this question, ask the same thing to Daniel, and what's something that you know now, but you wish you knew when you were starting out in specialty coffee?
That's a really good question. I don't know if I have a, I think... after that first cup of natural processed coffee from Ethiopia, I would have said, yeah, coffee is really awesome. Put all your effort into what you're studying in college to make coffee more, or just have like a more baseline in maybe agriculture or, you know, biology. Because I started off as like an art major. And yeah, you know, it's like went through all that, but still, you know, working in coffee. And then, you know, kind of went into the coffee. And now it's like ongoing learning. But if I could have just told myself like then to like study more agriculture or, you know, socioeconomics, I would have told myself to do that.
Yeah, I think that's great.
And then like do art like for fun. And, you know, I still do, which is cool.
Yeah,
but oh, absolutely. Think, you know, having those kind of baseline information on just those aspects of the coffee industry would have helped me just understand more things faster.
Yeah, so, absolutely.
Like, having to like really just work through everything as much as possible. But yeah.
Totally. No, yeah, I think that's great. I think too with the, I think that's what I love so much. And I think that's why I've stuck to roasting is just because there's so much of like, it's so fascinating to me that like elevation changes affect flavor and soil does. And like what does an organic stamp on a coffee actually mean? And is that necessarily a good thing? Like in America, we think like, oh, you know, and I think certain consumers like, oh, I want organic coffees. So, like, that's great. But is that sustainable? Like, is that a practice that actually can, you know, be sustainable? Like this is their livelihood. And if they choose to not use anything and it kills all their crop, like what do they do? You know? And so educating on like, yes, organic is good. Like there's nothing wrong with organic foods and coffees. However, these are the implications that come with that, you know, marketing buzzword, which is a good thing. However, it does have implications, you know?
Yeah, totally.
But, well, cool, Miguel. Thank you so much for coming on this podcast. You are a wealth of knowledge. I learned a ton. I know our guests will. Yeah, it was, yeah, it was fascinating.
This was really great.
No, thank you so much. And yeah, for our viewers, if you can leave a, give us a rating, give us some comments. If you want to hear other people or other topics covered, we'd love to hear from you. And thanks so much for checking out the Specialty Coffee Podcast.